Hey everyone, it's Casey, and this is episode 9 of the Parent Teacher Podcast. Thank you for joining me. My goal in recording these is to get some information out and have conversations that lend to our understanding of how to prepare kids for adulthood. So if you're a parent, or if you're a teacher, maybe a related service provider, I hope that you'll find these conversations I'm having useful in maybe expanding your knowledge or exposing you to a new idea or telling you something else that you should research. So just bringing in different perspectives. You can find more information on my website, which is reorientedadvocacy.com. It's summer, so I'm still in the process of updating my blog. I'd like to fill in a lot of the resources that I mention or have been inspired to bring to you through my previous conversations. So definitely check that out. This week, I brought on my former neighbor, Greg Chasson. He is a clinical psychologist. He teaches psychology and he works in a private clinical setting as well. And I knew that his focus is with individuals who have anxiety and OCD. Anxiety has been a huge theme, especially in my advocacy work. I work with a lot of families who have kids experiencing a lot of anxiety. And one of the approved interventions is CBT. So to be clear, CBT stands for Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. It's evidence-based. It is not CBD. It is not the CBD oil. My friends tend to think that that is what I am saying, and it is not. So anyhow, Greg and I got started. I asked him a little bit about his role. I'll put some more information about Greg in the show notes. And if you had a question, you can reach me. I'll pass that along for you. And he asked, am I doing this as a professional or as a parent? I think that it's almost impossible to separate those two things often. So we got started and he's talking about his kiddos.
So I'm a dad of two boys, 1 9, 1 7. Both of them are special in their own way, and the 7-year-old has some special needs that require some extra support.
It's funny how sometimes your professional training can be helpful, right, in parenting.
Yeah, I mean, it's sometimes it could be also a bit of an obstacle, but for the most part, I think it's been helpful. And most people I run into think it is an absolute blessing that my son has parents who, you know, my wife is also in the social work field. So they think that my son is very lucky to sort of be born into that family.
Yeah.
Given some of the things that he needs to work on.
Definitely. I'm friends with Greg's wife, Tasha. She is now a social worker. She just completed a program as well. I'm looking for an excuse to bring her on and talk to her.
Yeah, she's much more interesting than I am. So I think that would be a smart move.
She's very smart. So, I'll give a little more background because it's interesting. One thing that I knew I wanted to touch on today is on the Superflex program, just because I think we'll circle back to that. It was an interesting time. Both of us have recently moved, but on the block, I think, like you said, both you and your wife had some background that was beneficial to the kids. Same here with my background as a special ed teacher,
right.
Jack as well. And I remember hearing the kids from the block sitting on the front porch kind of telling each other, oh, you have rock brain right now. I think you have rock brain.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's something I'd like to explain in brief maybe as we get into it. But I have been fascinated with the idea of these cognitive distortions, mind traps, different sites have it branded as different things. I work a lot with students who have executive functioning issues, and one of those can be that really rigid thinking.
Yep.
And Superflex seems to be a way that it's been rebranded and made in kid-friendly language.
Yeah.
This concept that comes from a broader umbrella.
Yep.
Okay.
So I'm not entirely familiar with the origin of Superflex. I do believe it comes from an occupational therapy background, somebody who comes from an occupational therapy background. But truth be told, I think of most of the elements of Superflex echo what we try to do in cognitive behavior therapy when we work with people that have traits of autism spectrum and similar types of phenomena. I think it's a marvelous program because of not just the way that it leverages some of these techniques that we know have evidence base, but also because they do tailor it really well. They make it fun for the kids. They make it really easy and cute. I mean, it's not just about the rigid thinking. They also talk about social skills and other components that really are hiccups for a lot of these kids. Mm-hmm. And so it's not really just about the rigid thinking, although I think that's one that does really stick out, because when you said,
at least for us,
what are some of the,
at least for our kids,
right? What are some of the villains that they face in their mind? And the one that jumps out at me often is rock brains. It's funny that you use that one because it's so common, but also because it's easy to remember. It's just a perfect explanation and characterization of it. And so I highly recommend Superflex. In large part because I think it jives really well with the cognitive behavioral perspective.
Yeah, and we never formally have done Superflex, and really briefly, if you aren't familiar, you can find the resources. There are different books, and I think a lot of times school social workers even introduce these characters, and it's just, you know, it's a concrete or a representation that kids can understand of flexible thinking. So they're the superhero, or the brain is the superhero. And then there's these concepts that are represented as villains. And I think that's what really resonates. And it definitely connects with what I think is important when I work with people individually and in terms of this podcast, which is labeling mm-hmm. different patterns of behavior or values or beliefs. Mm-hmm. And I think that the act of labeling something is validating, and it helps people to make changes, to make positive changes.
As long as the labeling is responsible,
yeah.
And it's less about, I'm not always the biggest fan of labeling people with disorders, and there's a lot of sort of debate about the pros and cons of that, but I think it's important to acknowledge that there's both sides, right? There's also stigma and things, and lack of opportunity and discrimination that needs to be, you know, and that also can extend to family. There's something called courtesy stigma, where parents feel just as stigmatized as if they have a child, for example, on the spectrum. They can sort of get that feedback of the stigma from the public.
So courtesy stigma, I want to unpack that. I'm definitely going to link to that term. Mm-hmm. I love it when I learn a new term. I agree. One thing we've also talked about briefly before we got formally started, I was asking recently in a meeting, we were talking about executive function as a disorder, executive function disorder, which is not a thing in the DSM right now.
No.
However, again, just from my own experience, often when I'm working with a family and I come in and it's a kid who's really struggling in school, they may have really big gaps in different areas of types of intelligence, for example. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I have kids that are just really exceeding normal in visual spatial intelligence. And then I start to see these patterns that are related to executive function. So rigid thinking, again, is the one that comes up where I wonder, I don't like the term high functioning autism, mm-hmm. Because it implies low function, which I think is very judgy. I don't have a better suggestion. I don't know if you do. But you know, just in that, a lot of these, there's a lot of overlap, and it's not important what label or what diagnosis someone has.
That's the problem, right? There's no real easy, often these labels are used for ease of communication, and there's, as you start to move away from them, it gets really clunky, right? You're thinking, oh, it's somebody who's not neurotypical, but also has no cognitive deficits. Well, that's really a mouthful, right?
Yeah, it is.
So I understand the reason for labels. They're shorthand, they're easy. They're easy to communicate in science and clinical work and to parents and family. But we have to remember that it could be loaded. Those terms can really be hurtful or mean things to people.
I didn't even plan on expanding on this, but I will, especially in an educational context. Mm-hmm. If you're deciding on eligibility for a student after you have an IEP meeting, you know, there are times when you have a child who has autism, and it can look like behavior disorder. It can look like primarily mood or behavior or communication. You mm-hmm. could have a time when you have a child whose primary diagnosis was medical ADHD. And then as you dig into more of these executive function scales and look at the communication piece, you really do see more characteristics that look like autism. There's often mm-hmm. so much overlap. But the message that someone sees when they don't know the child, when they look at that one page, that first page of the IEP, can really I unfortunately think lead them to rely on stereotypes, which can cause a lot of miscommunication.
Yep. And they also form the basis for all sorts of stigma and other things. But again, it's very hard to have a system where you're communicating something else, like a number or with a range and a much more elongated description. I mean, sometimes you need shorthand things. So I see both sides. I just think we need to acknowledge both.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm curious about what will happen in terms of getting it right, that shorthand without a lot of information. You know, I was mentioning, like, as the DSM is revised, we always see changes there. We saw changes in the autism diagnosis the last time.
Yep.
So that'll be interesting to see if they get better at that.
What happens is a Cold War, right? So basically they come up with a name. It sounds scientific and legitimate, and then it gets a stigma and becomes derogatory, and then it switches to something new, and then that's good to go for a while, right? It went from, recently in my lifetime, it's gone from mental retardation to intellectual disability, and that's one example. And, you know, there's been things before that as well. And so it just keeps changing because of this, and I think that's just the way that we work. Try to make things legitimate and sound less derogatory, and then it becomes derogatory, and switch it again.
Yeah. And I can refer back to a previous episode I recorded where it was a parent talking about neurodiversity pride. Like, you know, there is a movement right now that kind of echoes, I think, the LGBTQ movement. And that's good to see, acknowledging strengths in people and not just those deficits, and also getting past the what we see visually, which I think is also... And those stereotypes.
It's
so representation.
Much more positive. I like that too.
Yeah. One of the things that I wanted to ask Greg about, because he works primarily with adults with anxiety and OCD, right?
Well, 9 and up. So not just adults.
Okay.
I see a lot of adolescents with anxiety and obsessive compulsive disorder. I do see some people on the spectrum who are able to sort of delve into things that are a little bit more complex. Mm-hmm. I tend to really, though, primarily focus on obsessive compulsive disorder and related conditions.
I always find it interesting because often I hear from a parent that their child has anxiety. And so they may have a diagnosis even of generalized anxiety disorder. Mm-hmm. And then as we start looking at what's going on, it's like poor working memory, like real overwhelm in terms of planning, prioritization. And so I always kind of go to, let's look at this from an executive functioning angle. And there's some real skill gaps here. But then the question is, chicken or egg? What came first? Is the anxiety derailing the ability to carry through a task and to get started? Or is it an underlying issue with ADHD or even autism that's causing the anxiety?
That is $1 million question. Or I should say that's probably a $2,000 to $4,000 question that you would ask a neuropsychologist. So that's the type of question that you would want to see consultation on, because it is exceptionally well sort of researched that anxiety has a profoundly negative impact on executive functioning. And so it's very much a chicken and egg. And my response is typically, it's probably both. And it's a cyclical or sort of recursive sort of problem where they're feeding back into each other and causing problems. But really, it's getting a little bit outside the realm of my expertise. But if you were a parent and wanted to sort of tease that apart, the best place to go would be a neuropsychologist to start looking into that. You could also go, again, seek an educational consultant or a special ed professional. But in the end, if you want to look at some of these neurocognitive profiles to tease out some of that, a neuropsychologist is going to be a good bet.
Yeah, let me address really quickly the pros and cons to seeking out a private neuropsych eval versus requesting at the school. So when a family comes to me, it's usually one of two cases. Either they have sought out a neuropsych eval independently and come back with information they didn't know about. And usually it leads to a diagnosis. Or they want to request an evaluation from the school district. In my experience, the measures that they use are all normed tests or behavior rating scales. They're going to be very similar. So an achievement test, intelligence testing, like a Conner's or something that measures behavior, which can be subjective. And now, thankfully, an executive functioning scale as well. Pro, if you can obtain an evaluation from the school district, it's free of charge to you.
That's a huge pro.
That's a huge pro. And frankly, if you disagree with some part of it, then you could seek a private evaluator. You know, con, you could get information that you don't know if you should trust. It could, you know, so if trust is really broken down with the school district, then, and you don't know which professional is going to do it, you don't have any choice over that. So seeking a private neuropsych can make you feel confident that you know what there is to know at that point in time, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it really depends on a lot of things. What district are you in? What professionals are they using? What are the professionals selecting to use as their instruments? But even beyond that, here's the thing. If you do your homework and find a neuropsychologist who's what's called board certified, then the amount of rigor that those folks go through in order to get that level of credential is not a guarantee, because there's no such thing in this world that every professional knows what they're doing, but it's much stronger because it's a lot of very rigorous work to get to that level. And really what's happening is that these folks are taking all this data and doing, working their magic to integrate all of it to tell a story about what's going on with your child. And so I think that there's a level of expertise and experience that goes with that that's really hard to find outside of that particular profession. Not impossible by any means, but oftentimes the neuropsych testing and other evaluations that are done by the school officials are just one of a series of different pieces of evidence that a neuropsychologist would use to construct their narrative about what they think is going on. Mm-hmm. And I mean, neuropsychologists are very careful to use evidence-based techniques. They're very careful not to overstep their bounds. They're trained to be very both skeptical and conservative. And that, you know, again, it depends on who you go see, but a board-certified neuropsychologist, I think, is going to be the maestro who's going to put all that together for you. I think it's a worthy investment, but it can be very expensive. Some insurance covers portions of it, but in the end, it's a pretty profound expense. And so if you can't navigate that or afford it, and it can really set you back. And so maybe the best place to start is the school system, especially if you have some confidence in what they'll do for you.
Yeah, I've met some school psychologists who sometimes I'm surprised, right? Because I'm not sure what it's going to, you know, what it'll be like. And I will say frequently, I really feel like the other benefit of having someone who works from the school, for the school district, is that they also are a little bit prescriptive. Like, they know what services or programs are available even within the school. Sometimes it's not such a good thing because they think inside that box, but it can be an advantage. So just getting maybe that cursory information there, and if it resonates and seems true, good, roll with it.
Right.
If there's some doubt.
Yeah. So a tiered approach makes a lot of sense, right? You go in, you get your school to do what they are sort of obligated to do.
Yeah.
Not sort of. They are obligated,
right?
And advocate for your kid in that way, or hire someone that can do that. And then if you're not satisfied with the results, you know, look at the report, see what they're doing, try to get a sense of sort of the motives behind some of the recommendations they're making, and try to assess if it's within the best interest of your child. And then if you're not happy with everything, and that should be a long-term question that you're constantly asking yourself, check in with yourself, you know, then take it outside and see if you can get those advocates and those professionals to evaluate what's going on.
Yeah. And the other thing I'll bring up too, which I'm sure many of you know, is that even at the school level, there's a reevaluation every 3 years. And that's because none of these are really fixed states either. A lot of times, you know, I think parents go through, you know, depending on your level of frustration, or I often hear people saying, like, we should have done something a long time ago, or we thought it was this. And there's a lot of guilt associated with, I think, any action you take as a parent that's only operating on the information you have.
A monsoon of guilt.
A monsoon of guilt, because we could always be doing so much more, right? Only you can't. So just knowing, too, that whether you go to the school or to the school will do it every 3 years. If you feel that there's a change or something, you can go more frequently. But that, you know, this is something that should be revisited, especially, you know, if you identify and your child gets a diagnosis young, often that can look very different 5 years down the line.
I mean, I've been told, or I've been under the impression, that you can pretty much ask them to meet at any time and bring them together and advocate for your child.
That's true. You can request evaluation sooner than 3 years. That's just the minimum mandated by law. And
yep.
Typically that's people's yeah. experience. You also can't evaluate too close together because a lot of the tests are invalid if you test,
sure.
you know, less than a year apart.
Yep.
So speaking of behavior change,
yes,
a big thing that I wanted to ask you about, because I also have ADHD, so I see a psychiatrist, and she has recommended to me before to see someone who works with emotional freedom technique. Are you familiar with the tapping, EFT? And then I read about neuro-linguistic programming, and I know that they don't have a lot of evidence behind them. I enjoy the affirmations that I hear on an EFT podcast. I do. But I wouldn't say that it's clinical in any, I'm just throwing out an assumption right now, because really Greg's, two schools, I guess, that you come from. Tell me more about cognitive behavioral therapy.
So cognitive behavioral therapy is often misunderstood as a specific set of techniques. But in reality, cognitive behavior therapy is really a worldview. It's a model. And within that, it's an umbrella term. And within that, there are various techniques and models and approaches that vary based on patient characteristics, clinical presentations, age, you know, that kind of thing. And so when someone says they provide CBT, that's a really sort of nebulous concept.
Uh-huh.
What is it that they really do? And you know, so I think you always want to sort of delve more into that, right? So there's the cognitive world of that. There's a behavioral sort of worldview. And then there's a lot of people who sort of marry those two.
Mm.
I tend to be much more behavioral than I am cognitive. But that's also because I work in an area where the behavioral treatments are exceptionally well validated for providing relief for people, right?
So
if you have obsessive compulsive disorder, or you have an anxiety disorder, or even sub-threshold anxiety symptoms, you'd make a huge mistake not to get behavior therapy. I mean, that's where all the treatment evidence supports it.
Okay.
Right?
So let me interrupt to ask two clarifying questions.
Yes.
One is, I minored so, so long ago in educational psychology.
Okay.
So very many years ago. And what I always think about is conditioning. So
yeah.
Like classical conditioning, Skinner. And
yeah, it rings a bell.
The rats, you know, and I'm sure we're going to bring up ABA too, but I'm just going to say, so to me, and the other thing I need to clarify is when I say CBT, by the way,
yeah,
it's not CBD, which when I've talked to a few friends recently about
the oil
CBT, they're thinking I'm talking about CBD, the oil, which I know is all the rage in, especially like ADHD communities.
Yeah, I'm in no way an expert on CBD oil, so I will not be speaking on that today.
Right. So, if I stumble, we're talking about CBT, so cognitive behavioral therapy. And so to clarify, when I think cognitive, I think internal, in your head, what you're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And when I think behavior, we think of external, what's observable, what we see. Can you set me straight a little more on that?
I mean, that's probably as good a sort of way of characterizing it, but it's not entirely sort of the best. It doesn't capture it perfectly, because
okay.
there are some people who think that thoughts are just as malleable and manipulable as behaviors, and that thoughts are just behaviors. So it really, you know, it really does depend on who you talk to. But in general, cognitive behavior therapy really comes from a cognitive behavioral perspective that assumes that thoughts, feelings, and behaviors are all entwined. They all impact each other. They're reciprocally related, such that your thoughts will impact your behaviors, which in turn affect your thoughts, and your thoughts affect your feelings, which in turn affect your thoughts. There's also indirect relationships, right? Your behaviors affect your thoughts, which then indirectly affect your feelings. So if you can think of it like a triangle, which is the hallmark symbol of cognitive behavior therapy, in which you have each point representing either thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, and the reciprocal arrows connecting all three of those to form a triangle. And I like to, with my patients and other folks, show them like really silly examples of this, right? If you show up to work and you realize you forgot your pants, you know, how are you feeling? And people will say, oh, I'm just absolutely humiliated. And you say, great, there's your emotion. and what thoughts are connected to that, right? Mm-hmm. They might say, well, if people are going to see me, they're going to think I'm an idiot. They're going to think wow, this lady doesn't shave her legs, like whatever, right? And then that is then, of course, connected to a behavior. And also you tend to clump other reactions in there, right? Like, I might run away, or right. I might crack a joke, or I might cover myself up. Those are all behaviors, right? And then those all feed back. If you cover yourself up, does that then lead to other thoughts or feelings? Maybe a little bit of relief now that people can't see you. Maybe you had a spare pair of pants, because everyone does, right? And so...
some people would, because I think that's the interesting part is like, it would be so cool if there was just a flow chart. Like, here's what happens. But everybody varies so much on every one of those points.
Yeah.
Both internal factors, like how you're born, temperament, and then conditioning, like socially, that nature and nurture.
But that flow chart is exactly what a cognitive behavior therapist puts together when they do their case conceptualization, when they work with people.
Okay.
They are trying to identify the contextual factors, both long-term sort of traits and other things, biological, as well as situational factors that contribute to a person's grief, distress, problem behavior.
So I think to break that down, you're saying it's identifying triggers.
Triggers are a part of it, absolutely.
And unpacking the feeling associated with things to kind of understand why the thought occurs then.
There's no specific order, though.
Okay.
It can start there's no like formula for what starts first.
Yeah. It's really, you know, one thing that I found really interesting, as I've gotten more into this is especially in my research on ADHD is that often we don't realize that we really don't understand what we're feeling. We're often feeling things all the time without naming it, without sitting like maybe being too general, and that really can have a big effect on behavior.
Yeah, there's actually, we actually all fall differently on a continuum of that awareness. It's called alexithymia, when it's really a poverty of awareness. So if you really lack the ability to read your own emotions and understand what's going on, there's actually a term for it called alexithymia. Yeah, now we're really getting into labels, right? Are you alexithymic or not?
So, I like vocabulary.
But this is a spectrum, right? So we all fall in. Some people are hyper aware of their emotional states. There's some people who theorize that maybe there are some personality conditions that actually reflect people being too aware of their emotional states.
It's this idea of threshold, which I think is really relevant because recently I listened to an OT speaking. And so she was saying that, you know, beyond the five senses, we all may have like a basic understanding of what occupational therapists deal with. And you know about proprioceptive, right? About your place in space and how that can be very regulating for some kids to be on a swing or spinning. And she explained it as the fact that as individuals, we all have very different thresholds for things. So I'll use my kids as an example. I frequently do. My son under-registers a lot of things. Yeah. And one thing that kind of relates to, I'm going to try and pronounce this, alexithymia.
Yeah.
Okay. Is interoception, which is feeling if you have to go to the bathroom. Are you hungry? Are you tired? It's monitoring your physical needs.
Yeah. And we have techniques that work on that, interoceptive exposure and things like that.
Yeah. So it
seems people aware of it.
Like the threshold is falling a little too severe in one direction or the other. It's not following that, I guess, typical range, or maybe it is, but for some reason it's causing problems with function.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what would be the approach you would take if somebody were to come in with, I'm really asking a general question, but what does it look like if somebody comes in with OCD? It's identifying these three areas with them?
Yeah, so it would, I mean, it depends because OCD is so variable.
Tell me everything and like, you know.
I would want to know what their sort of primary thinking processes are that underlie. Usually what I start with is the cognition, the obsession. What is it that's popping in? And we then have to separate out what are the intrusive thoughts, the ones that pop in that are invaders, the ones that you don't want to be there that are really upsetting, that feel inconsistent with who you are and what you want to be thinking about, right? We all have these intrusive thoughts. In fact, David Clark's done work on this. 95% of people report having them. The other 5% are probably lying or clueless, right?
Yeah. Thomas E. Brown is the ADHD guy who writes about, he calls it a virus in the brain. And it's really to what extent is it causing problems? Because it's true of everyone.
Yeah. I mean, you see it a lot in PTSD and depression, but OCD, those intrusions become very frequent, very intense, and very ego-dystonic, which means they're very alien to you. They don't feel like they're part of you, even though you know they're coming from you. You have to understand that they're coming from you, or that's not OCD, right? If you think people are inserting these things, then it's a different issue.
That's psychosis.
Right. But if you have this idea, even if it's a small kernel of insight, that these intrusions are coming from you and they're upsetting, then you might be dealing with OCD.
Does that mean you understand they're coming from you, but you may not even agree with them? Is that kind of what
people
it is?
People with OCD
they recognize
always.
That it's not sensical.
I mean, there's a varying degree of insight, but the hallmark of OCD is that there has to be a little bit of awareness that there's something not right about them, right? Whereas people with severe psychosis or delusional disorders, that level of fixedness in terms of how much they believe that thought is unwavering. Right. Mm-hmm. So sometimes there's a very thin line between those. And so it takes a really sort of specialized professional to figure that out. But most forms of OCD, there's going to be some level of insight. And that is often the motivator for bringing people in for treatment, because they realize that this is really problematic. But then those intrusive thoughts are then followed by more thoughts. How do you interpret that? How do you appraise it? How do you value it? How do you evaluate it? And then that then leads to all sorts of secondary emotions and other thoughts. Like, I can't believe I just had a thought of having sex with my boss. I'm married. I'm happily married. I feel like a horrible human being. I'm so guilty. This is awful. Am I a sex addict? What's wrong with me? Right?
Right.
I mean, that's just one example of a sexual obsession. But whereas other people may have that thought and think, oh, well, that was weird, and then move on. Right? Or even have it and think, wow, that was kind of hot, and then move on.
Right.
Somebody with OCD that has that kind of OCD would really get stuck on that and preoccupied out of people's control. And so part of the problem is that they have, a lot of people have beliefs that they can control that. And that's often what then leads to all of the problems, right? They think that they can control these intrusions, so they try to do things to push them away or distract or do other types of sometimes behaviors like compulsions and rituals,
right?
But even just things in their own head to try to control it.
Well, and that, so uh-huh. I'll come in with my amateur knowledge on that. I think of locus of control.
Okay.
And we talked about threshold, too high, too low. And I think of the locus of control, or interpreting everything around you as being either too much within your control or not at all in your control, more of a victim mentality.
Sure.
So simply martyr, victim.
Yeah. And when you look at anxiety, it tends to be associated with a lot of beliefs that you have more control than you actually probably really do. Right. Whereas depression, in my opinion, tends to be the opposite. You actually have more control than you think you do.
Oh, that.
Right. Because then there's a lot of learned helplessness and then hopelessness. Right.
I've never heard anyone break it down that way. And it makes so much sense.
Yeah. And the weird thing is that both of those tend to coincide, anxiety and depression. So it's a little bit of a weird paradox, right? Where you get people thinking that sort of end up on both of those extremes. But in reality, you know, what's happening is that this being consumed by these obsessions and engaging in all these behaviors to try to control it, which we call compulsions, to try to relieve the anxiety that come from the obsessions, they lead to all sorts of executive dysfunction. Now, some might argue that executive dysfunction predates the OCD, which very well could be, but there's no doubt in my mind that the anxiety and other distress that comes from OCD gets in the way of cognitive processing.
Right.
And I mean, in fact, there's a lot of research that says that people with OCD have specific patterns of neurocognitive performance, a lot of it in the executive functioning domains. A lot of set shifting research suggesting that people have a lack of flexibility and they're shifting from one thing to another.
So that goes back to rock brain.
Rock brain, exactly.
It's rigid thinking.
Yep. And then there's a lot of research that may suggest local processing bias, where people have a hard time seeing the forest from the trees, where they get stuck on looking. And again, that often is something you see in the autism spectrum.
It's overgeneralization, I guess, to put it really simply. So
that often leads to cognitive distortions like overgeneralization or
black and white thinking.
Black and white thinking. I mean, it's a really common cognitive distortion in people with OCD.
And I see it play out in schools frequently with relationships. So a teacher and a student relationship. Yeah. So here's a common scenario. You have a student who even has executive functioning profile laid out from a neuropsych eval. We know that their rigid thinking is an issue.
Sure.
And then that black and white thinking as well. And then you have a teacher who may see an ADHD diagnosis instead of autism, which may be more fitting given communication issues or anyway, there could be like two incidents that the teacher calls the student out and they're embarrassed in front of the class. And so in that case, the student might overgeneralize. That teacher hates me. I hate that teacher. And yeah. It's like nothing good ever happened, you know, or recency. Yep. I think anyone with young kids also knows this. The day could be a beautiful day. Yep. And then they don't get to buy a toy at the end of the day. And it was the worst day ever. It was a horrible day.
Yeah. Black and white thinking, all or none thinking. Sometimes what you described is called discounting the positive, you know, focusing on the negative. Here's the thing about cognitive distortions. You can they're highly overlapping and not mutually exclusive. And different theoreticians and practitioners have different labels for the different types. But the basic situation is that you're making assumptions about the world around you and you're filling in the blanks because we can't possibly process all the information around us.
Yeah.
And it's actually an adaptive feature that we fill in the blanks. We just we can't possibly engage all that information. So we make these leaps and assumptions. And the problem is when you're anxious and depressed, you tend to fill in the blanks in a very negative or nervous way. And so that's what these cognitive distortions are. And not all distorted thinking is problematic. In fact, some research says that people who are depressed are actually more accurate in the way that they're thinking about themselves and their performance.
I think about minimizing versus catastrophizing. So that's another variation, like you said, of like this overlap. And maybe it's the same thing. But if you're in a really awful situation, a really traumatic situation, and you can minimize it and somehow get through, we call that resilience.
Exactly.
So,
I mean, you look at this in any field, right? In sports psychology, which, you know, do you want your batter going up there thinking that they're going to strike out, or do you want them going up there thinking they're going to get a hit? And truth be told, it's much more likely that they're going to get an out.
Yeah.
Right? They're like, you know, even a good hitter's 70% of the time is not going to get a hit. Right?
Right.
But you don't want them going up there thinking that they're about to whiff it, right?
No. It's a mind game. Like,
it is.
You know, that's something I've talked to my kids about. Or anybody, really. It's like, yeah, I could, you know, I could let my head go there, but will it be helpful? No. So I play a game with myself.
Right. Is it adaptive?
Right. That's like, it's not helpful to think that way.
Right.
So I'm just going to take an action step and push the thought aside. I'm just going to take action. I'm not going to think about it.
Yeah, it's hard to do that, of course. And, you know, the problem with a lot of anxiety and depression, for example, is that the way that you're thinking about it isn't adaptive. And so these aren't the types of distortions that we work on. You know, if you come in and your distortion is accurate and not a problem, then I wouldn't touch it.
And I also want to just clarify, too, I don't mean to say that anyone can just change their thinking, that it's that easy. Because I recognize that, thankfully, while I have many, many areas of weakness and challenge, for some reason, I usually am pretty good at talking myself into or out of things, which has been really helpful. But I definitely don't want to imply in any way that somebody who has anxiety or depression could simply talk themselves through it. I think that's a very dangerous myth, because I think that's your job, is to guide them through.
Yeah,
and frankly, it's a process.
The best way to show them is through experience, not through talking anyway. So if you're going to get good treatment for anxiety and even depression in a lot of ways, you're going to want to make sure that your provider is doing a lot of behavioral work with you, doing homeworks and exercises out in the community and getting you to actually face the things that are causing you distress. Because talking about it is not nearly as powerful as doing.
Yeah, the exposure therapy has come up before. I liked the way that Lisa DeMore put it, and I've talked about her before. She wrote a really good book on teen anxiety, Under Pressure, where she says the thing about exposure is if you're afraid of dogs and every time a dog walks down the sidewalk and you cross the street, then you'll never encounter a good dog. Like, right. It will never happen. Yeah. So there has to be some push through an uncomfortable homework type of situation. So I guess my question is, outside of therapy, you know, how could teachers or parents understand this at a basic level to be helpful?
What is this?
So obviously collaborating with a therapist in some cases is appropriate. I know with younger kids. If you hear, I guess, like maybe you can and maybe you can't comment on this. If you hear somebody with this type of thinking, if they're verbalizing like an all or nothing type of thought in a classroom, it can be really frustrating. I've heard my own kids do it. What would your advice be in handling that, not knowing the individual? So I'm really throwing out a hypothetical, but do you have any tips on?
As a teacher, if you're a teacher or like a teaching aide or.
Yeah.
Oh, it's tough because, you know, you don't want to have people get in the position of feeling like they have to get into cognitive work with their students. But at the same time, those are some rich opportunities for working with them in the real world and getting them to maybe expand their thinking. And so I would probably make sure that you pick your battles, first of all, and make sure that the situation seems ripe for this. And then make sure that it's in line with whatever the educational aims are for that child. And if it seems appropriate and consistent with what the educational team thinks is good for this person, then I would dive right in. And if it's starting to feel uncomfortable in terms of how rigid or emotional the kid gets, I would probably back away and seek some extra help.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. It can, you know, I taught for a long time, and it can just be, there's a lot to do in a classroom. But I think having this underlying knowledge of, you know, this is what's going on, it's hard to undo. It's hard to undo those patterns that have been reinforced probably naturally over time. It's not your job as a teacher.
It's not, but it is an important job as a gatekeeper. So if you're starting to notice this a lot, not only can you start to report that back to the team, but also, you know, including the parents, but also you can track it over time. That can be very valuable outcome data. So if you're working on it and you're noticing that the child's becoming less rigid over time, maybe they're invoking things like rock brain or
Superflex, naming it.
Yeah, those are great metrics for how a kid is doing. So the teacher really is at the forefront of that.
I agree. Taking data is always probably the best answer, because the other thing we want to know is within a classroom setting, which is not a therapy setting, and unfortunately in schools, kids aren't getting a lot of one-on-one help with this, even through social work, knowing which interventions have been effective. So is it, okay, you can do it with a partner that worked? Okay, great. Yeah. It's good to know that. Is it, you refer to the growth mindset, you know, stuff you have around your classroom, like it's okay to make mistakes and that works, then good to know. But
I really do think though that sometimes having that somebody with an expertise in a specific area that's seen less frequently, like if you have a child with OCD, for example, or perfectionism, it's really, I think, advantageous to find somebody who has that expertise to talk with them. Maybe the child has a specific provider or seek a consultation, because there are often things that the school might do that feels very helpful, but in the end, it's enabling. Mm-hmm. It's actually reinforcing the anxiety problem, even though it feels like it's not. So giving temporary relief might have long-term consequences.
It's like, it's fostering learned helplessness over time too. Like I can do it only with that support.
I mean, that's definitely part of it. You're kind of teaching them that, but in general, I've often had to work with schools and saying, all right, here's what we need to withdraw that you've implemented, because it's actually making the anxiety disorder worse. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of times the teachers really appreciate that because they see the child get rapidly better once a lot of these things have been removed and proper treatment has been put in place. And unfortunately, a lot of professionals in schools don't have that specialized training. So I think the really critically is that school professionals need to know what the boundaries of their competence are. And that's really hard to teach somebody.
It's really hard.
Because there's got to be a lot of humility there, right?
Yeah.
But I don't walk around saying, oh, I'm an expert in treating ADHD. I have a very specialized practice. My life is devoted to working with people with OCD and anxiety. I live and breathe this every day. And I can assure you that, you know, that expertise is valuable and could, in fact, contradict some of the things that these professionals have done and learned in school.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough. I always stress to parents, well, first of all, whenever ego becomes involved in a team situation, we have a problem. It really makes things difficult.
Yeah.
And the second thing is, you know, with school professionals, even your special ed teachers, often it's a 4-year degree. Plenty of them have master's degrees, but I know I've sought mine in ESL, you know, so it might not even be in that reading instruction or that specific need that a kid has. It's hard to expect that everybody would be a jack of all trades. And so when you see kids who are really, really affected by these, I do feel like You may have social work even provided as a service, but it's really important to get somebody who has deep knowledge of that topic.
Yeah. And so that those are the, you know, and you see that a lot in school districts where there's, you know, where they tend to hire the best, they have the best resources, and, you know, the parents have the money to pay out of pocket for services out in the community. And that's where you end up, you know, getting the specialists who are able to sort of consult with the teams and kind of provide that. And I know that's not always available, especially for people who don't have those means. And in some sense, that reflects an unfortunate broken part of the system. But I think it's really important, and it can be a part of advocating, right? So even if you don't have the resources, the school is obligated to make sure they're doing best by your child. And so if you have anywhere to put your resources, finding someone that can advocate for you is so critical, because, you know, if the advocate can, you know, help find an hour worth of consultation funding to seek out somebody who specializes in OCD or specializes in applied behavior analysis or specializes in executive dysfunction, you know, and these are probably areas that a lot of school officials do have tons of credibility on, but, you know, there are things that they certainly don't. And I think it would be worthwhile for advocates to help seek out that Rolodex, if people remember what those are, of specialists.
Or even to connect them, because they don't actually get connected. So I'm thinking of one thing that comes up that's so difficult for parents and for teachers, especially, is when anxiety gets to the point of school refusal. This is something I'm called in on frequently. And I'm thinking of one program in the Chicago area that I've had some experience with is Alexian Brothers, for example.
They're now called Amita.
Okay.
But yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know that certain places are branded as like we specialize.
Yeah. Amita does great work. I'm really good colleagues with the person who's out there, Pat McGrath, and he's exceptionally well-trained and does great work out there.
I agree. I think that the unfortunate part is just the linking of the team to the outside service provider.
It's tough.
And
school refusal. I can talk to you about I have a whole podcast worth of stuff on that, because that to me is people often it gets really problematic because people don't realize that school refusal is not a single thing. It is an outcome, not a process. And so it's in the field what we call sort of equifinality. It's a single outcome that could come from a million different things.
Yeah. And you got to get to that.
And you absolutely have to get at the function of that.
It
right?
could be multiple things.
What is
going
the
on?
Function of that behavior? That is the ultimate question I ask myself for every single presentation of everything.
Yeah. This is definitely the functional behavior analysis part, which is I see done not well frequently in schools, especially for behaviors that are internalized. And I frequently will say this, like you have a nice kid who doesn't act out. So I'm really sorry, but you've been kind of screwed, because if they had been beating on the other kids in the classroom, this would have been addressed a long time ago. And I think for parents,
that's your recommendation, is that they should start beating up other kids?
Yeah. That's what I say. Tell them to start being a real jerk, and then we can get them some services.
Casey Lindeman, folks.
And often what happens is they turn into jerks at home, right? And then everyone at school isn't seeing it. But, you know, the problem is that as a like you said, it's hard to find the beginning point, but as a function of the anxiety, there's an escape. And so then determining how hard can I push this kid? When is the purpose escape? When is the purpose anxiety as you're trying to reintegrate to school?
Those two things are not mutually exclusive. Usually the escape is the function.
Right.
And what's the driving force is the anxiety. And you have to get a sense of what is the anxiety specifically and what is the escape mechanism, right? So the person could have anxiety about maybe performance, academic performance and perfectionism. Maybe their anxiety is about, and so the function is to escape that performance, right? Maybe the anxiety is about, I've had kids who don't go to school because the anxiety is about contamination. And so the function is to escape being contaminated.
Definitely.
Safety.
Social situations.
Social.
Friendships. Bullying.
Yeah. Bullying.
Gender.
I mean, frankly, sometimes school refusal has nothing to do with anxiety. It has everything to do with withdrawal during depression.
Right.
And so you cannot treat this as a uniform thing. It's really an outcome that could come from a million different variables and different things. And so when someone says, do you treat school refusal? My answer is maybe.
Right.
Because it depends on what's causing it.
Yeah. It's a big one. And it seems to be increasing. I don't know if I'll have to look at the numbers. But I definitely think we are seeing more and more kids, adolescents, teens reporting.
Yeah. Anxiety. Well, the problem is at school, how the school system has historically approached it, which varies a lot from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But a lot of the times it sort of had this assumption that we can control the kids and somehow get them there magically. But I've learned a long time ago with my own kids and with working with people that you actually lose control the moment they pop out. You think you have control. It's a nice little illusion.
Right.
You have some leverage that you can use to manipulate the context around them to get them to do things. But in the end,
right,
they can tell you to go screw off.
You can put carrots and sticks out there. And they might even influence the behavior. But then when you take the carrots and the sticks away, you have an individual who's going to make decisions based on what they actually value.
And the carrots and sticks, sometimes those don't even do what they need to do.
No, it's been, FBA, special ed advocate talk right now, functional behavior analysis and behavior plans are one, underutilized, but two, also often really poorly written because it's so much more complex than is this a performance deficit or a skill deficit? It's so many things. So,
they have people who devote their entire careers to developing treatment plans, case conceptualizations from a applied behavior analytic perspective. And I don't think it deserves short shrift, but it gets it a lot.
Yeah. So it might be a good idea if you're really struggling with one of these things to consult with somebody who specializes in OCD, for example.
Yes.
Outside of the school team and bring in that knowledge and bring them their data too from the schools. Like definitely, I think increasing the communication so that everybody can see a bigger picture of what's going on. Because often you miss one piece and realize that it was really important. So, to wrap up, I guess, we talked about what is CBT and how it's an umbrella, which I'm still wrapping my head around a little bit because I guess what Greg sent me straight, is that it is addressing three main factors: thoughts, behaviors, and feelings.
Correct.
And that identifying how one influences another can help ultimately improve quality of life.
Well, if you know how they are impacting each other in specific contexts, then you can design ways of intervening.
Right. You can stop one thing before it happens or react in a different way consciously.
Right. If you know a behavior stemming from the thought that I have to do this because otherwise I'm going to be anxious forever, and you know that them doing that behavior is contributing to the problem, then you can work on how to break that cycle.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Especially because then I think of what I do when I work with people, which is work on executive function skills. So if we recognize, for example, that prioritizing is an issue, prioritizing is really hard. And so I've been shutting down when the teacher puts a stack of work in front of me, not because I have a learning disability in reading, but because for now I need a graphic organizer that breaks everything into six steps and probably somebody to come over and coach me through two of them right now.
Yeah. And I, of course, as a cognitive behavior therapist would be very interested in the person's beliefs about their efficacy to do all these things. Does this belief and lack of confidence in doing this, or the belief that you have this trait or problem, how does that also contribute?
Oh yeah. Cause I'll bring up one more of those that we didn't talk about, which is magical thinking, which is I don't have a problem with it. You don't.
Yeah, I think the classic term is denial, right?
Yeah. I like magical thinking. It sounds magical. So
fantasy world.
Yeah, fantasy world. And then I guess so some of the takeaways from that are if your child is having problems, or if as a teacher you're noticing some patterns that seem to be related to patterns of thought or certain behaviors, take some data. As a parent, you can do the same. Definitely bring the school in on that. And then if you do end up seeking out outside help, bring everyone together as a team.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I suppose it depends. I mean, if the kid already has a pre-existing team, there's going to be an IEP leader. You can rope them in. If the child has no IEP or 504 or anything like that, you could be working with the parents.
And I would argue if they don't have an IEP or a 504, and they have something that's really impacting function outside of school, you might still want to talk to the school team.
Yeah. I'm just saying that might not sort of exist around that child's particular case.
Right.
And so what do you do in that? I mean, I'm sure teachers have avenues for how to bring that up, but I wouldn't be shocked if there are a lot of kids who fall through the cracks and have these things discovered later in their educational sort of trajectory. And the teacher's like, how in the heck has this been missed for the last 5 years?
Oh, yeah. Well, and frequently it goes back to what I see a lot, which is twice exceptional. Kids learn to cover this stuff up.
Yeah.
I see a lot of kids who have outstanding vocabularies. They just like go through a speech evaluation and have all these strengths. But then when you look at pragmatic language, there's a thin line between social and
because ultimately human beings are so complex and amazing that they are compensatory when things are problematic. They learn how to survive.
Oh yeah. And those kids can cover it. And then the teachers get frustrated. I see it all the time.
There are many ways to skin a cat, they say, right? So if you, and I love cats, so please don't hold that against me. But the idea being that, you know, kids can get to the same point from in different ways. And so if they're deficit or have difficulties in one area, they tend to be able to make it up.
Yeah. But it can cause a lot of anxiety.
Tons.
And they don't know where it's stemming from a lot of the time.
Absolutely.
So they might need Greg to figure out where it's stemming from. Or maybe I can watch him start a homework project and tell you, oh boy, I see a skill gap here where it's breaking down.
Yeah.
And I think the last thing that I want to just reinforce that was brought up earlier is that when we do too much for our kids, when you have, I'm just thinking like a child who has anxiety, or if you have a child even with some executive functioning issues or dysgraphia where they need help writing, it's important that you have some sort of a plan to have progress to independence. You can't just provide supports and stay there, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. You definitely want to start to slowly wean people off of these crutches so that they can learn how to be independent. Because ultimately, these higher levels of expectations when you get to high school and college and job performance, they're going to become, your expectations become much more intense and the consequences become very real. And, you know, you can't have an IEP if you're working in the real world. The protections and crutches are far fewer. And so you need to learn how to develop that independence.
Yeah. And that's where I think like really, I don't know if that's true for you, but it's true for me. It's always backward planning. But like, this is what success would look like with this. And as I said before, I don't really believe that a lot of things are fixed, but there are some traits that it's like, okay, this is not something that's a strength or something that comes naturally. Yeah. So, you know, being realistic and maybe I don't want to put myself in, I don't want to go to festivals.
Yeah.
Because I have issues with a lot of things at festivals. I'd be much happier going to a movie.
Yeah. So I think challenging expectations early on is really important. So what's realistic? But I also am very careful with that because the worst thing you can do is demoralize someone right off the bat and say, look, this is not realistic.
Right.
Like you're never, you know, I know that you're never going to be X, Y, or Z, or that's not possible. You know, you want to be very careful because that can absolutely have someone withdraw immediately from whatever process you're trying to do, especially if someone is all or none in their thinking and perfectionistic.
Oh, good point.
Right?
Right.
They're like, oh, forget it then. What am I even doing here? Small steps, who cares?
Well, and I think that the other thing to really factor in, and this definitely applies for parents and teachers too, is it's not really about what you want for the person. You do want like their ultimate outcome to play in as well, you know?
Yeah, unless it's wildly delusional, then it's a problem.
Sometimes it is, but I'm like, try not to project your own way of thinking on your child, on your student. We're all different. We value things in different ways.
And that's hard to do. We train for that in clinical psychology. And even with years of training and practice, it's still hard to do. You catch yourself not doing, like trying not to do it all the time.
But the goal is not, like Greg said earlier, and I think it's so valid. The goal is not to perfect the behavior. The goal is not to like make everything typical and everything. The goal is to increase independence.
Yeah. Functioning, decrease distress, increase the positive elements of people's lives.
Yeah. So thank you, Greg, very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
It was a little bit about CBT. I have a better grasp of it now. I'm sure that, you know, you only went to school a little bit and learned all of this anyway. So I'm sure it takes a long time. I'm going to link to one piece that I just think people will find interesting about the cognitive distortions, which I think are really interesting. They're just a little part. And another one to that triangle that you can see, and some other relevant things in the show notes. And if you have any questions, you can contact me. The link is on there. You can leave a voice message. And if you have a question or want more information about Greg Chasson, you can contact me as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.